Breaking the Glass Slipper, we believe it is important to have conversations about women and issues of intersectional feminism within science fiction, fantasy, and horror. To continue to do so, we need your help. Please consider supporting us on Patreon. Join the conversation by following us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram.
Hello, and welcome to Breaking the Glass Slipper. I'm Charlotte Bond.
I'm Lucy Hounsome.
And I'm Megan Lee.
Love is a common driving force for novels, and it comes in many forms. It could be the pursuit of true love, or the quest to turn unrequited love into a passionate relationship. Often it can be the loss of love that spurs a hero or heroine into action, leading either to a joyful reunion or a tragic acceptance that love, once lost, is lost forever. When considering how love influences a story, there is the trope of fridging, also known as the disposable woman, described by TV tropes as a female character who is present in the story just so that she can be attacked and or killed. Her attack spurs the story forward, and that is all. As we move away from literature that is dominated solely by narrow male narratives, people start to ask themselves what a disposable woman might actually look like, what her dreams or aspirations were, her fears or concerns, and what the world might look like if they still lived in it. Joining us today is Essie Porter, whose multi-layered novel Projections examine what happens when a man kills a woman he allegedly loves, and then that woman kind of hangs around as a ghost who won't stop screaming and now has to stop her killer from killing others whilst also falling in love. Like we said, this is a multi-layered novel. Thank you very much for joining us, Sarah. Please introduce yourself and tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and your books.
Hello, everyone. I'm Sarah Porter, or Essie Porter, for the purposes of this book. And I've written several fantastical and peculiar YA novels. This is my first adult novel to come out, Projections. And yeah, it's not really that different from my YAs, but that's because my YAs were not that YA.
So I said in my introduction that it is a multi-layered novel, and it is. It's got a viewpoint of Catherine present, Catherine past, and Gus as a projection. And it's a massively unique concept. So can you tell our listeners a little bit about the book without giving away too many spoilers? And what were your inspiration for the different elements? So like Catherine now, Catherine present, Catherine past, and Gus.
Ooh, okay. Well, the novel follows Catherine, who is murdered at the very beginning of the book and is left as a ghost attached to her ex-best friend, longtime stalker, Gus Farrow, who has killed her out of his obsession with her. And her ghost, unbeknownst to both of them, gets stuck to his back as he flees to Nautilus, the city of sorcerers, where she is attached to him permanently and cannot stop screaming. Dragged around with him, and they both then have to work from there in this rather unexpected situation, because the City of Sorcerers is full of magic, so once her ghost interacts with that magic, this is the result. Inspiration for the different strands is tricky. Let's see. I mean, there's three strands. There's an historical strand set in Western New York in the 1850s, which was a hotbed of feminism and abolition and spiritualism, and all of these movements were going on there. So it was a fascinating time and place to be writing about. And then that kind of developed as I learned more about the history of that era and became very excited about the history of that era. And so there's her history when she's alive. Then there's Nautilus and her undeath in Nautilus, which is... the inspiration is hard to put a finger on. It's a city made of thought. Magic in this book is a form of thought, and it is just the excess magic being siphoned from all these sorcerers that is the substance of Nautilus itself. So it's named after the way a Nautilus, you know, creates its shell with its secretions and creates this beautiful and perfect architecture. And similarly, the sorcerers create this beautiful and perfect, but entirely mutable and changeable architecture with their thoughts. And then The Last Strand was the original book, was the start of this, was the point of view of Angus, who is a projection of Gus, the sorcerer who has killed Catherine, who is still working out Gus's, I hate to say trauma, but kind of trauma, his agenda in our contemporary world. So those are the three strands that are coming together.
So the one with Gus as a projection, that was the original idea. Because I read in your author's note at the back that you handed in one manuscript and they went, this is brilliant, but we want some more. So yeah. Gus was the original. So what role did Catherine have in the original one and how have you adapted it? What did you expand on and what did you find to was most interesting about it that you went, yeah, I want to develop that for that shows up in the current novel?
This novel went through many, many iterations in over about 6 years, but it did begin as a YA novel. I had a new baby, Vesper, and I had the second half of a 2-book deal with Tortine. And so since I had this new baby sleeping on my lap, quite literally, while I was starting to write this, I was like, I'm just going to do a 90,000 word, like one first person point of view, not too ambitious. Wrap it up and get it done. Young adult novel about a boy who thinks he's a, an adorable romantic, but really he's a projected curse designed to kill the woman he loves. And, I sent this into my editor, Susan Chang, and Susan didn't get back to me for like a year. And finally, a year later, I got her editorial notes and she was like, oh yeah, this is great. But you know who I really want is Catherine. And Catherine at the time was just in a few scenes. She barely appeared. She was an important character because she was the original beloved of the sorcerer who made Angus, but she didn't have a lot of screen time. And my editor zeroed in on her and was like, I want her. I want Catherine. I want a second timeline. I want a second POV character. And by the way, could you make it adult? And by the way, could you make this like possession, but with magic? You can do that. And I was like, sure. I was very taken aback because I had never heard of a situation like this before. I've heard of books being moved from adult to YA, but never have I heard of something being moved from YA to adult. And it was also, at least an extra year of work. But it was also a really great idea. So once I thought it over, I decided to do it. And then, Catherine now is the main character, and the Angus sections have been cut to less than half of what they originally were. So she really developed all over again. It was sort of like putting two novels together.
I have to sort of laugh a bit when you say, oh, I was just going to do something really simple, this like projection of this guy who thinks he's really cute and in love, but actually he's like the projection of a stalkery crazy, like, yeah, super simple. Sounds just like... Okay, we have different definitions of simple, I think. But, we've been talking about Catherine, and in about a third of the book, she can't communicate. All she does is scream, as we mentioned. Like, how do you make a character that can't communicate a fully realized, character for the reader to grab hold of?
Well, that is tricky, and it's actually more than half the book where she can't speak. But yeah, she's an observer and she's forced to be an observer. She does try to act, but she's under extreme constraints because she can't communicate. But she can observe and she can think. And so she provides this pretty sardonic running commentary on the life of the sorcerers and Nautilus and also what is happening there. And she starts trying to scheme. She starts trying to calculate her way out of her situation. So there is a lot of tension to how little agency she's able to have, but also then that becomes the puzzle where she's trying to figure out what she can do and how she can act on this, extremely oppressive and miserable situation where people don't even realize she's sentient because all she can do is scream and she's treated as an object. And yeah, so that's her realization is mostly that calculation that, well, what
can I do now that I can apparently do nothing?
Yeah, that's an interesting place to find yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But I suppose that brings us back nicely, you know, to the concept of fridging, where in so many books, the women are unable to do anything because they're literally killed at the beginning and then kind of shoved off screen, other than to be, you know, hey, let's make the dude do something. But yeah, it felt to us like this book kind of is a reaction to that in a way, because the sorcerer, you know, he's kind of tried to do that in a way. But like, were you wanting to have a conversation with that trope, or was that just something that, you know, we as readers sort of read into it?
That's more you reading into it. But then, you know, those tropes are so out there that the conversations are kind of always going on, whether I'm consciously calculating it or not. The fact that it's there, you know, any book with a woman ghost who's been murdered by her stalker is going to be referring to that. But I wasn't trying to respond to it. I was responding more to the kind of the strand of toxic masculinity that presents itself as adorable and romantic, and that justifies everything. You know, the I'm so cute, I'm just true, I'm just in love, love conquers all, so therefore I can kill you because isn't it adorable? I love you so much. And I think that was more what I was in conversation with personally. But I mean, your interpretation is completely valid.
So Catherine is killed and used as a power source by a man. And that brings to mind the saying that behind every great man, there is a great woman. What did you hope to say about power with this very literal interpretation of woman behind the power?
I mean, again, Catherine is in this position where she feels she's lost all agency. And then ironically, she's basically being used as a battery and her power is being siphoned. And I think I've mentioned that thought is a form of magic in Nautilus. So he's actually draining the substance of her thought for his own purposes, which, yeah, is obviously a comment on any kind of situation where, you know, the woman is doing all the research and half the writing on her husband's novel or whatever, the kind of situation which has come up quite a bit in history and even more recently. Yeah, it's the thought that she can't claim authorship for because she can't speak, but she can still be exploited for it. And I have to say is that it happens, but she is missing a trick there in that she isn't quite realizing that if other people can use her as a power source, she has more power than she thinks. So I think that's also really what it's saying, is that if you can be exploited for your power, it's worth looking at, it's worth seeing if you can then reclaim it.
I like that. That's quite a strong, powerful statement. Like, yeah, if we can be exploited, we can also harness that power that's within us.
Mm-hmm.
So speaking about like agency and trying to actually harness one's own power, as can be expected, Catherine's unhappy with her situation in the quotes afterlife. And she wants vengeance, which can you blame her? She's been murdered by a creepy stalker obsessed dude. So we'd all want vengeance. I think that's fair. And I mean, personally, I'm a big fan of vengeance stories. Revenge tragedy, kind of old stories, plays. I love that, and actually studied at uni because I'm a big nerd. But, you know, with your story, you've got this kind of dichotomy that actual vengeance would kind of snuff out her own non/unlife that she does manage to keep hold of while he is still around with us. So we've got a couple of questions around this, but let's just start with, you know, were there any particular tropes related to vengeance that you hope to?
I don't experience it as a construction where I'm addressing tropes. And I feel like I run into these kinds of questions a lot and can't answer them because that's just not how I experience the process of writing a novel, which is really more like I feel like I'm witnessing the story and just trying to record what I've seen. So it isn't, I mean, there's always going to be those conversations, but I'm not constructing anything around those conversations in that way. I'm just trying to report back from something I'm experiencing as if I were looking at it through a window, and I'm just trying to be the reporter almost. So I find these kinds of questions very difficult in general.
Fair enough. Do you have any favorite like vengeance stories or anything that you really love reading about from vengeance?
I mean, the Anne Leckie trilogy.
Yes.
Justice, and that's an incredible revenge story and such a, oh my gosh, such a beautiful version of the AI gaining this sentience through trauma. That's just gorgeous. It's just gorgeous as an inciting event. And then that becoming, the vengeance against an act that, you know, the AI committed itself to, which is really profound. But such a beautiful book. So yeah, I'd go with that one.
I can heartily agree with you there. It's amazing.
Yeah.
When you come to sort of like Catherine and this whole thing about her, if she gets vengeance, she basically kind of kills herself, even though she's already dead. But you know what we mean. I mean, how did you overcome that difficulty of allowing her, or without spoilers, I guess, but of, you know, wanting to get vengeance, but also being aware that any kind of existence she does still have is contingent on her, in a way, not getting the very vengeance that she desires?
Well, I mean, at first, her goal is actually to eliminate herself because she doesn't want to be a streaking ghost stuck for eternity to her murderer, and she wants escape and release, and she's completely eager to eliminate her own, you know, her own undeath in this awful, nebulous position. But then, as the story goes on, she does get more attached to the possibilities of her undeath, and it complicates things for her. So, you know, I mean, it begins with her being like, this is terrible. I'm just stuck being this screaming thing. And she's trying to kill herself as much as him. That's as much the goal, you know, as the revenge. But then the plot thickens, as they will.
It does indeed. And I really wanted to ask about an element of the plot. And I hope it's not too spoilery to say that this does kind of turn into a love story. So it starts off with, obviously, we've got Gus and Catherine, and you can't see my air quotes for love story, because it's very clear that the love is very one-sided with Gus and Catherine and very selfish. But Catherine does fall in love with someone within the story. So without saying who it is, can you kind of say how this came about? I mean, when you say that you're a reporter, when you started off and you were writing it, did you have this idea that Catherine was going to fall in love, or did it just kind of organically grow out of the text as you were writing it?
It grew out of the text. I did not know that there would be the love story, and the love story wound up becoming one of my favorite parts, if not my favorite part of the book.
Me too. I loved it.
But I did not know. I mean, when the character you're referring to first appeared, I thought it was a sort of, you know, charming, whimsical, one-off moment in this magical city. And I had no idea of how important that character would grow to be. And then the character started speaking, and as she spoke, her importance grew for me. And I began to kind of, I don't know, tune in on her and see her and see where she was, what her place was going to be, but not for a while, not right away.
So when Catherine falls in love, we've obviously moved the action to Nautilus. And I mm-hmm. thought Nautilus was just an amazing place. It was a wonderful fantasy world. It's not related to my question, but I just have to stop here and comment on the fact that I loved how every time there was a power change, the whole city just changed, and how there was no nighttime or no snow unless someone in power went, yeah, you know what? Fancy a bit of snow. I really like that. So, I mean, feel free to talk about that if you want, but I did have a very mm-hmm. specific question. In Nautilus, you've got this idea that people expend magic on various different things, much like we would spend money. And one of the things they do is they alter their appearances. So we've got someone who feels far more comfortable in the guise of a frog, someone who wanders mm-hmm. around with their head is water with fishes in it, someone who wanders around as sort of a Minotaur-y kind of character, and so on. So was this just like a wonderful and fanciful invention of your world? Or did you kind of want a commentary on modern issues of gender and identity? Or did it start out as one and maybe become the other?
I mean, I think not quite the way you're putting it, but I do think it kind of began, you know, when people have this ability to alter themselves, there's the question of whether it's a frivolous masquerade or if they're actually getting closer to their true identities. Like, is it a sham or is it a new kind of authenticity? And I think Catherine's point of view begins thinking of it as this kind of ridiculous, contemptible masquerade. And then she comes to see that for some of the characters who she does care about, it is achieving their own authenticity in a way that people can, yes, with, you know, with gender, with explorations of gender in our world. So I think her acceptance of it is a commentary on that, for sure. As Catherine comes to appreciate what that power does for people she loves, and that some of the characters are in fact like arriving at their true selves instead of just putting on a show, you know, in the way that the Minotaur Asterion is putting on a show, and he's really just a poser. But for some of them, they're not posers, and they actually are more truly themselves in Nautilus than they can be anywhere else. And that's what Nautilus means to them. It's the refuge where they can become themselves.
I mean, it strikes me that the time in Nautilus is only, what, about a third of the book, I suppose? As in, if we take it as like three different timelines and we've got a third, one timeline in particular set in Nautilus. And there's so much more we could explore there. I mean, are you tempted to go back and write about other characters within it, do you think?
I would love to do a sequel in Nautilus. If my publisher was interested in that, I would be delighted to do a sequel. Yeah, actually, I mean, there's some spoilery things I could tell you, but if you look at the text, some characters' demises are maybe not quite as definitive as they at first appear. There's a little wiggle room.
I wondered about that. Yeah, I was thinking about a couple of characters who leave the page towards the end of the book. And I was like, would you write it with the same characters, or would you have brand new ones and have your old characters make like little cameo appearances?
No, it would have the same characters, or many of the same characters. And I know who the big bad would be if I got to do a sequel, but it is a character who is not in Nautilus. It is a character who we know from the human world, but I don't know if that will ever happen. So we'll see. It kind of depends on how this book sells, really, if Tor would be interested in doing a sequel.
I will keep my fingers crossed, because I would love to see another book set in that world. I think it's fantastic. And now I just want to know who the big bad is. So you said earlier that, you know, you get asked the same sort of questions a lot about this book. So I'm going to ask you a question, and either it's going to be completely out of there, or it'll be like, oh God, not this again. So thinking about the ideas of sort of identity within Nautilus, if you were in Nautilus and if you could change your appearance in any way and have something weird and beautiful, what do you think you would change about yourself?
Ooh.
Or would you just be you?
Would I just be me? I mean, I would love flight. I would go for something winged, but what winged thing I would choose, I'm not sure. But yeah, if I would go for something flighted and maybe bird-like, that would be my ideal.
Birds over butterflies, then?
Yes.
I don't know. Butterfly wings. Well, would they lift you up? Sorry, now we really are digressing. We should maybe have a whole extra podcast on this.
I'm thinking more like peregrine falcon wings, like diving at tremendous speed, swooping, that kind of thing.
Well, that's going to stain your mascara, though, surely, and put your hair all out of place. Well, Sarah, on that note, I have to say that it has been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. And it's been so much fun to learn a little bit more about Catherine. I would have liked to have talked a bit more about Gus, but it would have had so many spoilers. And there's one character that we mentioned and touched upon I would really love to talk to you about. So maybe if there's another sequel, you can come back and talk about one of my favourite characters in it. But until then, thank you so much for joining us and talking to us about Catherine's journey.
Thank you for having me on. It's been lovely to talk to all of you.
Breaking the Glass Slipper is written and produced by Megan Lee, Charlotte Bond, and Lucy Hounsome. Please help us spread the word. Subscribe and leave a review on your preferred podcast platform. We want to hear from you. Let us know what you would like to hear on the next episode of Breaking the Glass Slipper.